From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the president plans to raise the minimum wage for workers on federal contracts. We'll put that news in a Wisconsin context.
I think that is ultimately the call of this decade. It's the call of this generation, is to restore fairness at work and to make sure no matter what type of job you are working, that you have enough to support your family.
Later, how a historically cold winter fits into a warming climate.
This is kind of a blip. And let me add then, one reason that we're taking such note of this cold out is that we've had unusually warm winters for a long time.
A Stradivarius violin was stolen this week in Milwaukee. We'll revisit a 2008 interview about that instrument. And the 6 degrees of Milwaukee are celebrated at the city's birthday party. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke, glad to have you listening today. As was expected, President Obama unveiled his plan to hike the minimum wage for people hired on federal contracts during the State of the Union address last night. The increase to $10.10 from the current level of $7.25 an hour does not affect companies' current contracts unless a contract renewal includes other changes. That executive order comes amid a larger national debate over the minimum wage and local debates over so-called living wage legislation. A Marquette Law School poll out this week showed strong support in Wisconsin for increasing the minimum wage, but less support for raising it to $10 an hour. One group that's been pushing for increases in this area is an organization called Wisconsin Jobs Now. Executive Director Jennifer Epps Addison joins us on the line to talk about the subject. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you react to the news that President Obama is going to use executive authority to enact at least this singular hike in the minimum wage?
Well, I think the first thing I want to do is just say congratulations to the thousands of low-wage workers from fast food and retail workers, Walmart workers, and many, many, many federal contract workers who have been standing up for the last year going out on strike and demanding action on wages and income inequality. I think the president's announcement is one piece of the puzzle and one step to say that these workers and their concerns have been heard. The question is whether Congress and whether state and local elected officials will follow suit in addressing wages and income inequality.
Do you see this as kind of a foot in the door, if you will?
Absolutely. Look, what the president is really doing is saying that I have been calling on Congress for over a year to take action on raising the minimum wage, and it's gone nowhere because of obstruction in the House. So what he's decided to do is use the tools at his disposal. He reached into his toolbox and said, if I had the power, I would raise wages for every worker in the country. But since I can't do that, what I can do is use my executive authority to raise wages for federally contracted workers. In Milwaukee County, we have something very similar being proposed by County Supervisor David Bowen. Actually, will come up for a vote this Thursday. You know, this living wage law in Milwaukee County would ensure that people who are indirectly paid through taxpayers' money in Milwaukee County are no longer working poverty wage jobs where they have to rely on public assistance just to get by.
You referenced the idea of poverty wage jobs. I mean, what do you see as the point of the minimum wage in 2014? Is there a difference between the idea of a minimum wage and a living wage?
Well, I think that that's really important. And what you'll hear, I think, if you talk to most low-wage workers is that while the president's plan is a step in the right direction, it certainly doesn't accomplish the goal. The president believes, the Pope has said recently, that we believe in a country where everybody who's willing to work hard and play by the rules can earn enough financial security that they could live independently and not have to rely on federal assistance. Unfortunately, $10.10 an hour isn't going to get us to that goal. So there's much work to be done to make sure that hard work in this country results in fair pay. And you have fast food workers and other low-wage workers standing up and demanding $15 an hour, as well as the right to form a union without retaliation. And I think that is ultimately the call of this decade. It's the call of this generation, is to restore fairness at work and to make sure no matter what type of job you are working, that you have enough to support your family.
Now, one of the reasons that the idea of increasing the minimum wage has been bottled up in Congress for as long as it has is that there are some who believe the minimum wage increases unemployment. Some economists, I guess, are divided over it. Should we be concerned that a raise in the minimum wage could then result in a reduction in the number of jobs that are actually out there?
Well, I think this is sort of the false big boogeyman economics that has ruled the topic of conversation. the same people who spout off this idea that increasing the minimum wage hurts low-wage workers are folks who do not bat an eye, who say absolutely nothing as CEOs and executives give themselves double, triple digit increases in salaries. If the, you know, owner of McDonald's, the CEO of McDonald's can triple his salary last year, then he can also afford to pay his workers a living and a fair and a decent wage. And I think the rest of the country has really woken up to this. And if you look at recent polls, the vast majority of Americans support raising the minimum wage. I think that the public is well ahead of politicians on this one. And why shouldn't we be? We're not the ones who are beholden to these multi-billion dollar corporations. There used to be a time in this country where when productivity went up, when profits went up, when companies were making more, the average worker was also seeing an increase in their salary. And unfortunately, that's just not the case. Wall Street has fully recovered. It's seeing record highs. CEO and shareholder dividends are at the highest levels they've ever been. And yet, for some reason, worker wages remain stagnant. And that is, to me, the real role of the federal minimum wage, of minimum wage laws at a state. It's to hold accountable businesses who see massive rewards and profits from taxpayer investment. It's to tell those businesses that we expect a fair return for your workers if we are going to be investing and helping them make your corporations and your companies incredibly profitable.
But short of another bill that would require companies to lower executive salaries, it sounds like the workers could still be squeezed out.
Yeah, I mean, the history of increasing the minimum wage hasn't really borne out a lot of these scare tactic ideas that have come out of conservatives by and large. I think right now the pulse of the majority of economists, the pulse of the majority of the world really is that we've got to do something about income inequality to reduce income inequality. We've got to start investing in workers and their wages. And common sense tells you when 70% of your economy is consumer driven, which the American economy is, that the only way that you are able to rebuild and boost your economy is if you get more money in the hands of people who are going to go out and spend that money right away. And we know here in Wisconsin, there are more than 600,000 workers who would benefit from seeing the minimum wage increase to 10.10. Those workers are going to go out and they're going to spend their money in their local economies. They're going to boost up those economies and they're going to create new jobs because of that spending. That's how the American economy works, about 70% of it. So we know that this is not just a good policy for workers, but it's an economy-boosting policy for our state.
There are many who would like to tie the increase in the minimum wage to inflation, the rate of inflation. There are, though, some who are concerned that a broad-based wage hike would actually increase the rate of inflation, mm-hmm. and it might be a no-win situation, that as soon as you raise wages, the buying power of those dollars would decrease.
You know, again, I think these threats are scare tactics. Here's the reality. I'm an avid McDonald's eater. I am not ashamed to admit it. I go to McDonald's a lot. When I first started eating at McDonald's, you know, you can get an extra value meal for $3. Now the average extra value meal is about $6.50. So prices are already increasing. Anybody who goes to the grocery store knows that prices have increased. The question is whether or not we're going to ensure that wages continue to increase and increase at the same level as the cost of living. And unfortunately, that is not what's happening. What's happening is that we are seeing massive and record profits from corporations. And the reason they're making those profits is because they're squeezing workers and expecting more for less. It is time for us to join the movement of low-wage workers across this country and to demand a fair wage for everyone. I am incredibly proud of what has happened here in Wisconsin, because not only have we led the nation in having multiple cities go out on strike for $15 an hour in a union, but here in Milwaukee County, County Supervisor David Bowen and his colleagues were far ahead of the curve and have proposed and been working on a living wage ordinance that would give a real living wage to workers here in Milwaukee County, a wage that would allow them to get off of public assistance. And they've been working on that for the last 6 months, well ahead of the curve. They're showing the leadership that this state needs. And we would really encourage every municipality to follow the president's example. He used what tools were available to him to address this crisis. And we believe every single municipality in the state from the city to the county to the state government should use the tools they have available to address the good jobs crisis in Wisconsin.
Speaking of the state government, there's currently a bill proposed in the Wisconsin legislature that would bring the minimum wage up to $10.10 an hour, but phase it in between now and 2016. Is that a significant enough step for you?
Well, again, you know, we believe that we shouldn't just be talking about the minimum wage. We need to be talking about a living wage that allows workers to live independently. No worker who gets up and goes to work every day wants to come home and rely on a public assistance program to keep their lights on or to feed their children or to make sure that they have medical coverage. These are things that we believe all hardworking Wisconsinites deserve. Now, short of that, we recognize that this is a political climate that is challenging and that the polling out there shows a majority of support, even a majority of Republicans support the idea of raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. What I would say is that if we could have brave Republicans step outside of the governor's words, because we know that the governor's main concern is running nationally on a Tea Party ticket, but if we could have the majority of thinking Republicans in our state really focus in on what's best for the workers and for the communities of this state, we believe that they would join Representative Mason in a bill to raise the minimum wage for $10.10. So for those reasons, we do support the bill with the acknowledgement that the workers in this state, not only are they demanding more, but they need more. We really believe that a fair wage for every worker is $15 an hour with the right to form a union with no retaliation.
The other argument that you probably hear a lot of, but I'm curious to get your take on, is, you know, people say, well, it's all well and good to be talking about these large corporations, but what do you say to business owners who might be looking at, you know, shaky finances, who say, you know, they're not sure they can afford to pay workers more and keep the lights on and the doors open?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the reality that folks have to understand is the majority of low-wage workers and minimum-wage workers are being employed in large corporations. They are being employed in our hospitals. They're being employed through our county or our local governments. They're being employed through the federal government. They're being employed through multi-billion-dollar corporations. That is the majority of folks that are struggling under these low wages. In terms of the small businesses know more than any other type of company how important their customers are and how important growing their customer base is. If we continue in an economy where we're taking more and more money out of the pockets of your everyday workers, whether that's a fast food worker or a state employee or someone who owns their own business, if we're taking more and more money out of their pockets, then there is nothing left to help stimulate that local economy. Raising the minimum wage will do more to boost the sales, the customer base, and the revenues of small businesses than, you know, nearly any other policy that we can reasonably pass.
You talk about kind of a two-prong issue here, the idea that a living wage really is $15 an hour in this day and age, but you also call for the right for everyone to organize collectively. Why is that second part such an important part of the equation for you?
You know, honestly, I have to say that this is an education that I got from the brave workers I've had the privilege of working with and alongside for the last year. When we started talking about raising the minimum wage to workers, their reaction was, that's great, but I still have all of these other issues that aren't related to how much money I'm making. Those issues were things like wage theft, being forced to either work uncompensated hours or having money stolen from their paychecks by being forced to use these prepaid debit cards that charge astronomical fees. They were fair scheduling and the right to be able to pick up a second job to be able to support your family because you knew exactly when and where you had to go into work the next day. A fair process for grievances and dealing with things like sexual harassment. These are the types of issues that workers need to address on a daily basis, and the best forum and the best way for them to do that is to be able to form a union. It's the only way to have any level of parity between you and your employer. And so while we talk about people needing to make a decent wage, at the end of the day, what we're really saying is that everybody in this country deserves dignity and respect at work. Dignity in the wage that they make, but also dignity in their treatment and their expectations for treatment with their employer.
Jennifer Epps Addison, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Epps Addison is executive director of the Milwaukee-based organization Wisconsin Jobs Now, which advocates for increases to the minimum wage. President Obama's State of the Union address included plans for an increase in the minimum wage for workers hired through federal contracts. The president's State of the Union address came on the heels of Governor Walker's State of the State address last week. Lake Effect contributor and essayist Art Sear takes a crack at the state of the world economy.
Nattering nabobs of negativism is probably the most enduring of the many alliterative pronouncements of Spiro Agnew. He was vice president in the Nixon administration until forced to resign because of corruption. This particular phrase, penned by Nixon speechwriter Bill Sapphire, derogatively denigrated diligent reporters for placing bad news above good. Why, Agnew asked rhetorically, did the malicious media not put priority on the positive? He attacked pusillanimous pussyfooters allegedly allergic to America. Inspired by the positive points of the spirit of Spiro, good news, Agnew, below is a list of definitive developments that definitely deserve dissemination and discussion in 2014. First, democracy is becoming the accepted way of life for the world's population overall, not just the privileged few. As recently as three decades ago, people in Latin America lived almost uniformly under various degrees of authoritarian, dictatorial rule. Today, Fidel Castro's Cuba is literally the only remaining dictatorship in the Americas. Despite pervasive state control and an internal security apparatus which is rightly feared as well as respected, the increasingly desperate need for foreign investment is forcing Havana's geriatric communists to loosen their iron grip. Even autocratic Hugo Chavez of Venezuela had to face the voters, and near the end of his long rule, he lost on occasion. Once, tiny Costa Rica was the beacon of freedom south of the border. Now that light spreads throughout the Americas. Likewise, reasonably honest and genuinely contested elections are spreading in Africa, Southeast Asia, the former Soviet Union, and, on the local level at least, in China. In global context, the dramatic Arab Spring, therefore, is the latest manifestation of a worldwide drive toward fair and representative government. The Korean Peninsula is especially instructive in this regard. While attention is focused on the apocalyptic rhetoric and brutal actions of the North Korea regime, South Korea continues remarkable positive economic and political progress. South Korea's duly elected first woman president, Park Geun-hye, was inaugurated at the start of 2013. She is the daughter of the late President Park Chung-hee. When she was very young, her mother was shot and killed by a North Korean assassin aiming for her father. Despite past traumas, she seeks cooperation with the North, extending a stable hand of friendship. Second, market economics likewise is spreading as alternative ways of producing wealth and prosperity are discredited. Deng Xiaoping's declaration of people's socialism for China in 1992 has become a benchmark event for not only that nation, but the Asia region as a whole and beyond. The Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement between mainland China and Taiwan is an historic result of the free market economic revolution. Virtually all economic barriers have come down. In consequence, Taiwan's role as source of investment, trade, and expertise for the mainland is vastly expanding. Third, remarkable global progress proceeds from a base of extraordinary growth in economic production over the long term. Yale historian Paul Kennedy, in his book The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, notes total world industrial manufacturing rose from an assigned base level of 100 in 1900 to over 3,041 by 1980. And this has continued. In industrial nations, the average human lifespan doubled in the 20th century. For more on the improving human condition, you should consult the Cato Institute's libertarian volume entitled It's Getting Better All the Time by Stephen Moore and Julian Simon. As these developments imply, free competitive economies and open competitive elections are interconnected historically and currently. Adam Smith's classic book, The Wealth of Nations, appeared in 1776. Not coincidentally, that is the same year the American Revolution began.
Essayist Art Sear is Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. The case for climate change when it's 10 below zero, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. I don't need to tell you, it's been a cold winter. December was 5.5 degrees below normal, and so far, January is almost 8 degrees below what's typical. But consider this, even as you take off your scarf and your earmuffs and your wool socks. Data now shows that 2013 was the fourth warmest year in the world since records have been kept, and it was the 37th straight year that global temperatures exceeded their average. George Stone teaches natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College and joins us from time to time to talk about climate change issues. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. It's great to be back.
As we're having this conversation, I think it is maybe 10 below zero in downtown Milwaukee. Why would you contend it's important to be talking about climate change right now when we're having what is the coldest winter in recent memory in Milwaukee?
Well, I think there are two important reasons, Mitch. One is people shouldn't get the impression that this means that the warming of the planet has slowed down or reversed. That's very important to make that point. And number two, a great many climate scientists believe that this cold polar vortex, a phrase that we've become familiar with of late, is actually a result, although it's counterintuitive, but is actually a result of global warming, particularly warming of the Arctic.
Well, we'll get into that in just a moment, but let me ask you this. I mean, you're someone who's talked about these issues for a long time. It must be somewhat frustrating to you to have to say every time there's a cold snap that this does not mean the end of climate change.
Well, it is, but I'm used to it now, Mitch. For one thing, deniers or those who, for one reason or another, refuse to accept the evidence, the reality of global warming, will seize on every weather event which seems at first blush to be counter to the trend. They'll seize on that to say, aha, where's your global warming now? So I'm just used to that. I think people who understand the climate system and who are at least somewhat knowledgeable about it realize that extreme weather events will be on the increase as a result of global warming, and know that also there's natural climate variability, which is independent of the long-term trend of global warming. And so we're going to get major cold snaps like this. But to be more specific again, many climate scientists believe that these Arctic outbreaks of late are actually a result of global warming due to the warming of the Arctic, disruption of the polar circulation called the polar vortex.
Well, yeah, connect the dots for us, because it does seem counterintuitive, the idea that, you know, it's 10 below zero in Milwaukee and below zero temperatures are widespread across certainly the northern half of the United States. How is that connected to a greater warming in the climate?
Well, a long-term, again, it's due to warming of the Arctic, and the Arctic is warming faster than any other place on the planet. The average temperature has increased 5 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 50 years, and in some cases as much as 7 degrees, which is really a huge amount of average warming. The sea ice, as many people know, over the Arctic Ocean has been getting thinner and smaller in extent annually. But the effect that causes these cold snaps is a disruption of the polar vortex. Now, the polar vortex is a counterclockwise circulation around low pressure just south of the coldest air, the Arctic high. And when that polar vortex is disrupted, as it has been by the warming of the Arctic, then that cold air in the Arctic can break through. The polar vortex kind of acts like a fence, in a sense, that holds the cold air in the polar region. But when that polar vortex is weakened, as it has been in the last couple of winters, then that cold air in the Arctic can break loose and swing way farther south. And the jet stream, which follows the boundary of that cold air mass, swings way far south. And in fact, this latest cold outbreak extends all the way down to northern Florida.
Well, and we should also mention that at the same time we're having these remarkably cold temperatures in Wisconsin and across the United States, there are some remarkably warm temperatures in the southern hemisphere.
Well, absolutely right. We have to remember, we tend to be kind of geocentric and think that the United States is the whole planet, when actually the surface area of the United States is less than 2%, 1.9% of the entire planet. So what happens here is not representative of the whole planet. The planet continues to warm. In fact, the year 2013 was the fourth warmest on record. November was the warmest November ever recorded. December was the third warmest December ever recorded. So what's happening in the United States is not representative of the whole planet. And as you point out, there are record heat waves in Australia. Those who follow tennis know that the Australian Open was disrupted by excessive heat over in excess of 110 degrees so that the players couldn't continue. California now is experiencing its longest drought in history and unusually warm temperatures. So this is kind of a blip. And let me add that one reason that we're taking such note of this cold outbreak is that we've had unusually warm winters for a long time. I can remember just a few years ago, we broke the record for consecutive months above zero. I think we went something like 3 years without ever going below zero, which is extremely unusual. I've been around here for a long time. I can remember back when we had what we like to call real Wisconsin winters. January 17th, 1982, Milwaukee hit 26 below zero. I was living out near West Bend at the time. It was 30 below zero out there. Then again in 1996, the same date. I remember that date because it was my mother's birthday. January 17th, 1996, again, Milwaukee hit 26 below zero. This morning, we're 10 below, 11, 13 below, and we think it's a really big deal. But we're just getting used to this much milder winter regime, and so when we do get a cold outbreak, it seems much worse than it otherwise would have.
There's also some news within just the last week that some of the corporate interests are paying attention to climate change. Coca-Cola announced that climate change has had a real disruption in the way they do business in other parts of the world. What does the corporate world's sudden interest in global climate change mean for the overall discussion of the subject?
Well, I think it means that we will be able to really address, since they're recognizing the problem, it will mean that we'll be able to address the problem and get some meaningful measures passed, not only nationally in this country, but internationally, where it's, since it's a global problem, that's where action is really needed. So it's a good thing. One of the reasons they're recognizing the impacts of climate change is that their insurance rates are going way up. Munich Re, one of the biggest insurance companies in the world, issued a report to their annual report last year indicating that the last 3 or 4 decades have seen a great increase in extreme weather and climate events. And the billions of dollars of insurance that they have to pay out has skyrocketed, so they have to raise their premiums. The World Bank, just this past fall, issued a major report underlining these same effects, that extreme weather and climate events are on the increase. They're going to continue to be on the increase. It's going to be more and more costly. And then, of course, the precipitation patterns are changing. Sea level is rising. Heat waves and prolonged droughts are affecting agriculture. So many of the supply chain positions for these major corporations are feeling the impacts. And I think it's finally, you know, we're going to get some action because of this result.
We talk about climate change a lot in terms of tipping points. Is there an economic tipping point? Do you feel like we're on the cusp of economic forces driving some change?
Yes, in some parts of the world. Unfortunately, well, you can say unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view. In the United States, we're experiencing a fossil fuel boom, primarily due to the success of the new technology called hydraulic fracturing or fracking, and that has greatly increased the supply of natural gas. We're now becoming natural gas exporters rather than importers for the first time. It's reduced the price of natural gas. This is having a negative impact in the development of renewable energy. And incidentally, we'll be talking about all these subjects at the Sustainability Summit on March 26 and 27. But that's kind of a positive impact for this country's economy, but it's delaying action. And it's softening the position of the climate scientists who are telling us that we need to transition away from fossil fuels to clean technology and green energy, renewable energy.
Well, George Stone, we will chat, I'm sure, as the Sustainability Summit draws nearer. But right now, thank you so much and stay warm.
Thank you. Same to you, Mitch. And I look forward to our next talk.
George Stone teaches natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he's organizer of the annual Sustainability Summit scheduled for this March at the Wisconsin Center in downtown Milwaukee. He also joins us now and then to talk about climate change. A priceless violin is stolen in a Milwaukee armed robbery. We'll listen to a 2008 interview about the instrument when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee police and police around the world are searching for the instrument we're hearing now. It's the Lipinski Stradivarius, which has been on loan from anonymous benefactors to Milwaukee Symphony concertmaster Frank Almond since 2008. The instrument was stolen from Almond in an armed robbery Monday night outside Wisconsin Lutheran College, where Almond had just finished a concert. The instrument is said to be worth millions of dollars. Shortly after Almond received permission to play the violin publicly, he visited the Lake Effect Studio along with Stefan Hirsch, a violinist himself and co-owner of Darnton and Hirsch Fine Violins in Chicago. Speaking then, Almond described the first time he played the Lipinski Stradivarius.
I just played it for a few minutes, and even after sitting in a vault for a year and not really being played much for probably 10 or 12 years, it was pretty amazing. I mean, you could tell what it was, definitely.
It's got such a big sound, and I know that's something, it's one of the largest ones that he made, right?
It's on the largest pattern. He was prolific at exactly this period. 1715 might be one of the years of his absolute most output. But not all the instruments from this period are on this big pattern, and the most desirable ones and biggest sounding ones have this large pattern and a huge amount of airspace and flat arching, which produces a lot of projection.
Well, in 1715, what would an instrument like this be used for? That's sort of the height of the Baroque period. Would it be a solo instrument?
Mostly what they were doing was chamber music in a broader sense.
These were the super high-craft post-Renaissance trinkets of the wealthy. If you had your own castle, certainly you wanted to have your own orchestra in-house. And if you were really keeping up with the Joneses, you wanted to outfit them with the best that was available. And
keeping up with the Medicis.
Yes, there you go. As it were. And literally and figuratively, Medicis did own Stradivarius. And there are documents that exist now that show us that Stradivarius orders came from far and wide, and they were sometimes whole big sets of instruments. And that's how things like this came into being. What they were used for were probably, you know, concerts in there, relatively large by personal standards, but small by today's concert hall standards, performance spaces.
Which were basically large rooms, you know.
Like salons.
In castles.
A salon, a ballroom, yeah. Something like that.
Well, Frank, once you started playing it, is there anything you had to adjust in the way you play to work with this instrument?
Yeah, they're all different. You know, I mean, I've been really fortunate in my life to have a number of different great instruments, including a couple of Strads. And every single one, you change your playing a little bit, and it changes to you. That's also something I think a lot of people don't realize, is this mysterious thing where the instruments really do sort of adapt to how you approach them in a certain way. It's very difficult to describe that, and I don't really know why that happens, but it definitely does. You know, an instrument like the Dishkin Strad that I had sounded completely different when somebody else would play it, and I'm sure this one is the same. So day by day now, I find myself approaching things in a different way and the instrument responding in a different way. It's just a different kind of instrument when you play on it regularly versus when it's just sitting there not being played. You know, it's just something happens with it and it sort of comes alive. I think also you almost have to learn how to work less with these instruments. There's an ease of execution with a lot of different things, different technical aspects of playing. And in that sense, it can really act more as a really high-end tool for what you're trying to do. It gives you options. An instrument like this is so powerful and has so many different kinds of shadings and colors, coupled with a range and an evenness that makes it, I wouldn't say easy, but easier to do what you're trying to do artistically, if that makes any sense.
You're it's not like fighting the instrument.
Right, but it's also like somebody giving you a much wider set of, a much broader palette of colors to work with, to use that analogy. It's just more things you can do. So in that sense, it maximizes everything you're able to do and probably maximizes your strengths as a musician. But sometimes it can also magnify your limitations.
Yeah, the part that Frank is alluding to here is that all of the benefit that he speaks of, which he achieves with apparent ease, I know how hard he works, but not everybody out in the audience might know. In fact, you can get all that achievement as long as you have the precision it takes. But Stradivarius do not suffer fools very well. And you do have to be fair, especially with this type of Stradivari. You have to be fairly precise, accurate, and firm. You have to know what you're doing, kind of like with a thoroughbred horse. Will respond great as long as you give it the right input. User error, though, results in near disaster.
I'm perfectly capable of sounding very, very bad on this instrument. But I think this is an important point, though. A lot of people think that if you gave a lousy musician a great instrument, it would completely change everything, and it doesn't. It just sounds like, you know, a not so great musician on a better instrument. And the other interesting thing is that I think a great musician, still a great violinist, when you hand them any different instrument, they still sound like who they are. Like, I remember, you know, famous examples around here, for instance, when Pinchas Zukerman would show up and he'd demonstrate something on somebody's violin from the section, it would unmistakably him. It clearly is not the instrument he's playing on.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about determining the provenance, because I know that was part of this story. Yes, there's paperwork, but paperwork can be forged over centuries. Is there something that you look for, and Stefan, this is probably more of a question for you, something that distinguishes a Stradivari, you know, that you can say, yeah, that's a real one, not a fake?
People ask that sort of a question, and they're looking for the magic secret, if you will. In fact, there's a million things on a violin like that that distinguish it, that where it screams what it is. The process of looking at something like this involves a lot of detailed examination, because we always wonder if there's parts of it that have been replaced or things that have gone on, or we want to verify what our sensibilities are telling us at very first.
You should add that that's very common, by the way. There are a lot of composite Strads out there, because over the 300 years, somebody might replace the head or replace a piece of wood here and there.
Well, the old methods, it meant that the whole front of the instrument would be replaced if it cracked. They wouldn't think to start putting cleats and repairs like we do now. They would just say, well, it's not practical, put a new front on. And so, yes, we very often see that. And then some nefarious practitioners, particularly in the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, used to pull old instruments apart and make two out of one. So we, you know, as a authenticator, expert of these things, it's a job for us to try and decode and make sure we don't pass along problem children that way.
You know, it's worth noting also that if you have a Strad, say, of this level, where, for instance, the top would be different, you know, that's like conservatively probably $1 million difference, right?
These days, could easily be more.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on a lot of other factors.
Yeah.
In the case of this instrument, because it is so important and well-documented, those issues were much less difficult. I knew before I went into the bank vault what I was supposed to see. There's extant literature with photos of this violin. So it was, you know, more of a question of, is this the violin that's photographed? But with 1715 Stradivaris, I mean, you get down to only one person can actually be responsible for that, because the level of the work is such that nobody can replicate it. And as far as these identifying characteristics, you can't expect to solve the secrets of how these are put together any more than you could solve the secrets of how an important piece of furniture was put together or an important painting was painted. And it's not about using the right canvas or the right paints. It's about the interaction with the material. And so people frequently say, what was Stradivari's secret? Well, what was Rembrandt's secret? I mean,
yeah, that's a point that's really, I think, a lot of people miss, because everybody talks about, why can't we make these things like this today? Well, you know, nobody's painting the Mona Lisa today,
right?
Either. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it,
and he's that part that's missing.
It is, and I think the confusion that people have is the Stradivari still functions better than its current counterpart than anyone currently can make it, despite some people's claims to the contrary. I mean, there's a reason that the market holds up. It's not just the value of the things as antiquities. They really are gorgeous and better. And that functionality creates confusion for people, because there's no other object in the fine arts world like that. A Biedermeier chair actually is probably less comfortable than an IKEA chair.
Probably. And I'd be afraid to sit in a Biedermeier chair.
There you go. Some people
but
are afraid.
But you're not afraid to play. Well, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, what is it like to pick up something that's worth millions of dollars and actually have to perform on it?
That's great.
Yeah. Harder to crash that than a Ferrari.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, if I thought about it all the time, I'd go completely crazy. You know, I got my first really great instrument loaned to me when I think I was 11 or 12. And you just try to not do anything stupid most of the time. It's like having a small child with you most of the time. I just have to remember and focus on that. And other than that, you know, I just sort of go about my life. And I can't really worry about anything out of my control happening.
The thing to stress here is it's not really about the money for anybody who cares. The responsibility goes way beyond the money. So they were worth hundreds of thousands years ago. Now they're worth millions. Later they'll be worth more. That's not the issue. It's posterity. This is a very finite supply of objects, 600 some odd Stradivari objects in the world. If one is gone, when it's custodially entrusted to you, and then you have to sort of live with yourself having taken something away from posterity by being irresponsible. Frank understands that. Anybody who has these things understands that. It's more than money.
Right. They're not making them anymore, and they never will.
That's right.
And, you know, that illuminates a sort of disparity between two different philosophies about these instruments. There are people who really believe that the best way to preserve these is not to have them out and circulating. As a player, I instinctively rebel against that. But I kind of understand the point.
It's funny because Frank's being polite about it, but that exact debate he talks about is one that he and I have had many times because I'm, in my world, I'm hyper-conservative. I don't believe that they should never be played or shouldn't be loaned out, but I believe certain of the purest examples would just be better if they were not in circulation with musicians, simply because they need to be preserved for future generations.
Milwaukee Symphony Concertmaster Frank Almond and Stefan Hirsch, co-owner of Darnton and Hirsch Fine Violins in Chicago, speaking with Lake Effect's Bonnie North in 2008 about the Lipinski Stradivarius, which was on loan to Almond. The instrument was stolen in an armed robbery Monday night outside Wisconsin Lutheran College. The investigation is ongoing. One last break, and then one of the city's top networkers expounds on the secret to her success when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The city of Milwaukee turns 168 years old tomorrow. I know it doesn't look a day over 167. Its current population of around 600,000 is obviously much larger than it was when Milwaukee incorporated in 1846, but in many ways, it's a city that is still seen by many as small and tightly knit. The Milwaukee Press Club is seizing on that concept as it throws the city's annual birthday party tomorrow. The group is spotlighting the 6 degrees of Milwaukee, which is not just the air temperature it might be outside, but the idea that we're all connected to each other. The Press Club put out nominations for the 6 most connected people in town, and we're joined by one of the people recognized. Erica Conway is co-owner of a company called C2 Graphics Productivity Solutions, and she joins us this morning by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This award, this recognition, is directed at you as someone in town who's important to know and is well-connected in the community. What do you think connects you so well with the Milwaukee community that people would think that about you?
Well, I've spent most of my professional career here in Milwaukee trying to connect, at least in the creative community, and that's expanded to the folks I've met through the Metropolitan Association, the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce, as well as extending through LinkedIn, which allows me to have a broader community of folks that I talk to. I don't like to sell. I like to have people in the community who I can just call and say, hey, it's Erica, I have this opportunity, or wondering if you have a need. I prefer to call my friends and just see what's going on rather than call somebody cold. And so because of that, I've spent the last 14 years cultivating those kind of relationships so that I can either have somebody give me an intro to someone I don't know or perhaps take my call because they know of me or know me.
Do you think the climate for that has changed in Milwaukee in those 14 years that you've been doing this?
You know, I have been calling it Smallwaukee for probably about the last 5 years. It seems as if once you have like a good network in Milwaukee, it grows exponentially because people are friendly enough to be willing to make introductions. And I think LinkedIn and several of the organizations here in town have really made an effort to collaborate. So there are online communities and people are collaborating amongst them. There are Meetup, which didn't exist several years ago, which also allow people to connect around topics of interest. And then there are the professional organizations who, even early in my career, I made an effort to help those organizations connect into one big setting. So we used to do this MIMA Mix It Up, which is Milwaukee Interactive Marketing Association, and we would pull together the Business Marketing Association, AIGA, which is the American Institute of Graphic Arts, ad workers, and several other groups that kind of serve the creative community and bring them together for networking and collaboration. So that has grown quite a bit now that there's the Creative Alliance Milwaukee, of which I'm a board member, and that group has really tried to connect the for-profit advertising agencies, marketing firms, for-profit creatives, as well as the performing arts, fine art, and individual artists around the city and around the region, really. So that's been really exciting because it also is an economic development component to it, which is kind of saying, like, come to Milwaukee or stay in Milwaukee. There's a really rich cultural life, and I've been thrilled to be a part of that because it does involve education and the fine and performing arts, which before the Cultural Alliance, which became the Creative Alliance Milwaukee, that really exposed me to lots of different organizations and lots of different individuals outside of the creative community.
You mentioned the reputation, the term that people use, the idea of small walkie. And there are some people who might think of that as in negative terms that, you know, that makes us feel provincial. But you would argue that small walkie is a good thing.
Milwaukee offers all of the culture of a major metropolitan city with a high degree of relationship. When you talk about the 6 degrees of Milwaukee, it's true that you really can talk to somebody and find out that their brother's cousin is somebody who works with someone you know. Or, I mean, that happens all the time with when I'm talking to people. I'm amazed at how small and connected the community is. We can get anywhere within 15 minutes in the metro area. That's brilliant. So I would take Milwaukee over Chicago any day because it's high relationship, easy to navigate, has all the resources we need. I don't think small walkie is a complaint at all. I think you get much more community and resources and friendliness in this town versus going to a larger place where making connections may be far more difficult just based on either geography or the kind of nature of people's attitudes.
You were the co-owner of something called C2 Graphics Productivity Solutions, also just known as C2. What do you do? What does your business do, and how do you feel like it connects to the Milwaukee around you?
C2 is a training and staffing firm for creatives. So our target market is working creatives who either need to get software training, we're the only Adobe-authorized training center in the state, who want to upgrade their skills either to move on to a new job or so they can do their job more efficiently. And then we're also a staffing firm, and so we represent working graphic designers, creatives, production artists, copywriters, art directors, and help them either do temporary work to supplement their freelance, or we help them get full-time jobs or long-term jobs. So I have, like I mentioned before, I don't like to sell. I like to just connect. And so I've been working with all the professional organizations. I've been on the board of AIGA and MIMA and BMA over the course of my years. I think it makes sense for C2 to be there. We sponsor a lot of things. We sit on boards. We are members. And really, we do that not so altruistically because we really want to make connections with people who we either serve as clients or that we recruit as talent. And again, it makes it a little easier to make a case for why they might want to take part in our services if we've already been taking part in their community in a meaningful way.
So you were recognized as a good person to know in this community. Let me turn the tables on you and ask you who you think the key people that other people ought to know that you know in Milwaukee might be.
When I was notified of this, that I had been nominated, I instantly thought, my goodness, I know I could name 10 women off the top of my head that people should know in Milwaukee. Tracy Carson, who works at Zizzo Group, she's tremendously connected. Ann Zizzo herself is also tremendously connected. I think Lucy Klebar, who works at St. John's on the Lake, she has cultivated an amazing network that spans her current role as well as her role in the creative industry, as well as roles in sales and education previously. That woman knows everyone. I think the gals who work at the MMAC as salespeople, specifically Barb Smith and Jane Backus, those ladies have an incredible network as well because their membership, which is large, they're connected to all those people regularly. And it benefits me to be connected to them because if all I have to say is, do you know so-and-so? And the answer is always yes. Linda Crawford, she worked at the Business Journal years ago and has been in sales. She also knows everyone. There's not a person you can ask her about that she's not either connected to somebody who knows them or connected to directly. I'm sure there are men who are as well connected as some of these women, but those are the people who came to mind immediately when this nomination came up. And I thought, wow, I am a princess of networking. Those ladies are the queens. But I took the nomination nonetheless.
This is all happening as part of the city of Milwaukee's 168th birthday party. Thoughts about the city turning 168 years old?
Well, I was at the party last year, and it was this incredible celebration of how cool Milwaukee is and what kind of things were happening in Milwaukee. Rocky Mark, he's another one that who is super connected. I'm pretty active with the Third Ward Association, as well as trying to be active somewhat in the city. And I think last year, the party really did highlight a wonderful cross-section of how the city connects with businesses. And I expect that that will be even more in focus this year with the 6 Degrees of Milwaukee.
Well, Erica Conway, congratulations on your being a part of the 6 Degrees of Milwaukee. I imagine a LinkedIn request couldn't be far behind. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Erica Conway is co-owner of C2 Graphics Productivity Solutions. She's one of 6 people being recognized tomorrow for being the most connected people in the city. That's part of the city of Milwaukee's 168th birthday party put on by the Milwaukee Press Club at Bartolotta's Grain Exchange. There is a link to more from wuwm.com/Lake Effect. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Hike. So great to have you listening today. And I sure hope you'll be able to tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.